You're listening to the New Evangelicals Podcast. Welcome to the New Evangelicals Talks. I'm Tim, the host of this segment. Join us every Monday as we talk to all different kinds of people at the intersection of theology, politics, and culture, helping you navigate a better path forward in your faith. Oh, friends, wow. Just had an unbelievable conversation with the one and only Jim Wallace. I am emotional after it. We talked offline for a bit after. Whoa. Some of the things he said to me were just really encouraging. If it helps you to know this, Jim believes in the work that we as a community are doing. He calls us a community. He believes what we're building here is essential and more important than ever. Jim Wallace, if you don't know, is a legend. He started Sojourners Magazine back in, like, I think the 70s, and he's been around the block, deeply invested with the Black church, and man, he has quite the story. So I got him on. He has a brand new book that just came, or is coming out April 2nd, that talks about white Christian nationalism, and not just what it is, but how do we combat it, and how do we build better paths forward? So this is quite the conversation. Just buckle up. I am really encouraged. I don't want to say things that maybe, you know, were setting confidence to me or that come across weird to you, but I will just tell you that some of the stuff that Jim said was very encouraging to me personally and also very humbling and really just frankly reinforced that the work that we're all doing, that, you know, and I really mean that, whether it's the audience, whether it's our donors, the board of directors, Adele, Noah, Cherry, you know, that's our podcast producer, our fundraising coordinator, and our strategic person, all of those people, we're doing good work. And people like Jim are encouraged, and that means something because Jim has seen a lot. So I really hope that you enjoy this episode. It was so good. If you want to support the work that we're doing, sharing this podcast or YouTube video would be so helpful. Donating really makes this possible, friends. Like, there's no other way around it for me to say it. Without donations, we can't do this work. And when people like Jim Wallace say, "You're doing great work, keep going," I think, okay, awesome. Like, all the more reason to make this stuff possible. I'm not saying that if you don't donate, you're not, you know, you're somehow not giving to God or that God won't bless you. This is not that. What I'm saying is that without financial support, we can't do this work at the level that we are doing it, and we can't grow into this work at the level that we want to keep doing it at. So if that's you, many hands make light work. It does not take many of us. Less than 1% of our audience donates, and we're able to be very efficient with that money and become one of the leading digital-first organizations that are loud about a better way forward in their faith and tracking Christian nationalism. So if you want to help support that work, you can donate via the link in the show notes. All donations are tax deductible. It is so good and such an honor and privilege to do this work. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Jim. It is just chef's kiss. So talk to you all later on. Have a good one.
Hi, my name is Angie. I live in Southern New Hampshire, and I am a monthly donor to the New Evangelicals. I decided to donate because I've experienced the wonderfully supportive T&E Facebook community. I have been deconstructing and decolonizing my faith, and it's been a tremendously lonely journey because I don't have anyone else to talk to about this. When I joined the T&E Facebook group, I felt so welcomed and included, and I have thought many times, I have found my people, and this just feels wonderful. We have all had different experiences with evangelicalism. We are all at different stages in examining our faith traditions. Everyone in the group doesn't share the same spirituality, but the thing that we do share is that we are of one mind and being supportive of each other. I believe in the work that T&E is doing. I want others to experience this too. Thanks so much.
I got to be honest, Jim, it is a treat to have you on the podcast. I mean, it's been amazing to chat with you behind the scenes, and to have you on talking to the audience is just, it's unbelievable. So thank you for making time out of a very busy schedule to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I really have enjoyed our conversations and your New Evangelicals. That's what we started doing 50 years ago. And even that language from 1970 to 1980, all the coverage in the religious and political press was young evangelicals are changing evangelicalism. 10 years. That was the whole story. It was a very, unexpectedly successful launch of Sojourners. But then in 1980, literally political operatives from the Republican Party who told me decided to take over evangelicalism. Mm. And Richard Viguerie, who was one of the three who did it, he, Paul Weyrich, and Terry Dolan, he's told me that he went to Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and said, give us your lists and we'll make you household words in America. Mm. And they did, and he did. Mm. And he was our equivalent to the internet guru. He was the direct mail guru. Yeah. And that created the moral majority. And my dad, my Plymouth brother and evangelical father at the time, said, Fall isn't an evangelical. Mm. He's a fundamentalist who wants power. So there wasn't a backing off from even centrist evangelical establishment leaders who all signed our Chicago Declaration in 1973. It was a political takeover. Mm. And that political takeover by the religious right is now culminated in this theocratic support for Donald Trump.
That's why it's so important to have you talking to our audience, I think, and to really get your voice out there, because you are someone who has seen the beginning and the roots that have been laid for decades that eventually have given us the fruit of what we're experiencing now. You know, the term we use is Christian nationalism, white Christian nationalism in particular, and Trumpism. And I think a lot of people, and listen, I count myself as one of them, when Trump really came on the scene and was endorsed by so many white evangelicals, it was very disorienting for me, because I was, even though I was baptized in that conservative evangelical framework, it still didn't add up. So to have someone like you say, actually, you know, I kind of saw the roots of this, and I've seen kind of the cycle that we've been in now. It's important to have your wisdom here, because a lot of people, and I'm one of them, but there's many others who are trying to navigate this new path forward for our generation, when in reality, folks like yourself have immense wisdom, because you've, at one point, were carving, and still are to a degree, but at one point were that person who was carving new paths and thinking about the world that you were living in. I mean, take us back to, like, for you, the beginning of all this, of what even launched you into becoming Jim Wallace and writing books proficiently and having your own center. Did you grow up in evangelicalism or fundamentalism and eventually worked your way out?
Oh, yeah. I was Plymouth Brethren. In Detroit.
Yes. Yes.
And I got saved one night where a revival preacher who was, we were told he'd be fiery, and he was. He pointed his finger. All the unsaved kids had to sit in the front row. The closer you are to a sermon, the more it'll impact your life. That's why the front rows are always empty in churches. And he pointed his finger, it felt like right at me, and said, if Jesus came back tonight, your mommy and daddy would be taken to heaven, and you'd be left all by yourself. It got my attention. I'm getting up in years. I'm six. And so I told my mom, what do I do about this? And she said, oh, it isn't that wrath of God stuff. God loves you. God has a plan for your life. So I said, well, I like that better. So, okay, that's cool. I signed up. But my big conversion came. Evangelicals have lots of conversions because they need them. My
test
came as a teenager when I'm now listening to my city of Detroit, Motown, Motor City. And I'm having these questions. Something seemed really big and really wrong, and nobody in my white neighborhood, white church, or white world, white school would talk about it. So I'm asking these questions of the adults around me, and I'm starting to read the newspapers and listen to the news and have adult conversations. I'm 15, 16. And it was clear they didn't want to answer any questions. Mm. And the only honest answer I got back was, if you keep asking these questions, son, you're going to get in lots of trouble. And that proved to be true. And one night an elder took me aside, and he knew I was going back and forth to the inner city. I tell my students, trust your questions and follow them to wherever they take you. Mm. And that's what I did when I was a teenage kid in Detroit. And I went into the city. I showed up at black churches. Just showed up. I was never told there were black churches. Well, I just found them and showed up. They're Black Plymouth Brethren churches.
Mm.
Right. And so I took jobs alongside young men like me. I needed money for college. And they're young Black men like me. But maybe they could tell me why things are so different in Black and white Detroit.
Right.
And their life stories were so different than mine. Yeah. And they changed my life story. You know, so that was the beginning for me. And I left it. So I left all that. I went to, it was an elder. I'll just say this quick story. An elder one night took me aside and said, son, you have to understand, Christianity has nothing to do with racism. That's political.
Mm.
And our faith is personal. Mm. And that's the night that I left in my head and my heart, because what was ripping me up, turning me upside down, if that had nothing to do with Christianity, then I don't want nothing to do with it either. So I joined the movements of my time. I was secular in college, organizing racism, Vietnam, poverty, and we organized. I shut down Michigan State with my friends. They brought me back for a commencement once, and I said, thanks for bringing me back. It's the last time I was here. I shut it down.
Poetic justice.
but I really left my faith because of that, like a lot of young people do in your constituency. A lot of your folks know that story. They could tell.
Oh, totally.
You know? They have their own story. But for me, finally reading Ho Chi Minh, Che Guevara, and Karl Marx wasn't enough. And so I never quite got shed of Jesus, even during those secular years. So after the student strike and all that, in 1970, I went back to the New Testament, and I just read these scriptures. I never heard a sermon on the Sermon on the Mount in my evangelical church. This was the principal catechism of Jesus' teaching for all his disciples.
Right.
They thought it was for another dispensation when we all get to heaven. Well, that doesn't help us much here on earth. But the text that was my conversion text, where I found in Matthew, Jesus says, it was me. I was hungry. Mm. I was thirsty. I was naked. I was a stranger, meaning immigrant. That's what the word means. I was sick. I was in prison. And as you've done to the least of these, you've done to me. That was more radical than any of the Marxism I was reading. And I said, that's it. I'm going to sign. I wasn't going to be a Christian, but I was going to be a follower of Jesus. And that text has changed me my whole life. It's like when we put immigrant kids in cages, we're caging Jesus. When we don't aid impoverished families, when we deny them aid, we're denying Jesus. When we, instead of educating and serving young Black men, we arrest and kill them. We're arresting Jesus. That's what that means. Jesus couldn't get clean water for his kids when all the white suburban Flint people had clean water for their kids. That's Jesus. So that text has changed my whole life. I came back to Jesus, or found him for the first time, because of text. And in this new book, all those texts are there, because if we don't find them now, we're not just going to be run by a racialized autocracy.
Right.
We're going to lose democracy.
Yeah.
For all its flaws.
Yeah.
And things, which I've spoken of for years.
Yeah.
We're going to lose democracy altogether, and theocracy will come into play. This bad religion, white Christian nationalism, is bad religion, bad theology. And so, you know, the subtitle here is Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy. Mm. So I've written lots of books, as you say, but this is, to me, the most timely book I've ever done to this moment.
Thanks for sharing all that. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, because you have such a wider perspective than someone like myself. I mean, I was born in 88. I was born in the evangelical ethos, and I'm only a few years out of that basement of fundamentalism, kind of breathing some fresh air in. And I try my best not to be super hyperbolic when I'm talking about the threat that currently faces us, but I also want to be realistic. In your estimation, based on what you've seen in your lifetime and the places you've been, do you feel like the white Christian nationalism that we're experiencing today is another level of extreme? Or do you feel like this is kind of the cycle that white evangelicalism has always participated in? It just looks different based on the timeline.
It's not a cycle. It's a culmination.
Okay.
It's a culmination. Back to what was wrong with our childhood. I didn't have the words to use for that elder in that conversation, but I later found them, which is, God is personal, but never private. And the privatizing of faith is the greatest heresy of the evangelical world. We had established leaders of evangelicalism join us, the young evangelicals like me and Tony Campolo and Ron Sider and John Perkins, all the young evangelicals, they all joined us in signing the Chicago Declaration. You all should look that up, 50 years ago. And it said everything that I believe was right there, and they all signed it. But we had it wasn't them backing down, it was a political takeover. And what we have now is a crescendo. White is crucial, because race is at the core of all of this. And we have a battle. I quote Frederick Douglass in the book. We've always had these two kinds of Christianity. And right now, let me put it simply in one sentence. People on the other side, and I know a lot of Republicans who are homeless. It's not Republicanism. It is autocracy. Mm. It is a coming dictatorship. It is a strong man who likes a strong man around the world. And what's happening is an idolatrous religion making an idol of the nation. And then a heretical heresy religion. Heresy always takes Christians away from Jesus. And that's what this is doing. It's taking them away from Jesus. So this is the culmination of all of that. It's gotten worse. And we're either going to survive this threat. It's a threat to democracy and to our faith, the integrity of our faith.
Yes.
And a whole lot of young people, like I talk to every day and you talk to every day too, they're watching to see how the church comes down. And if the church doesn't come down on the side of the values that we say we believe,
yeah,
they're not going to ever go back to church.
I don't go back and forth on this anymore. I have a strong opinion on this, but I would like to hear your opinion. You know, I hear sometimes people say, oh, well, this white Christian nationalism, it's not true Christianity. You know, it's not the true faith. But I think that is too narrow and also absolves us from responsibility of the reality that the Christian tradition throughout world history has been used as either a tool of liberation or a weapon of oppression. I mean, there have been Christians who have done things and who believe what we might even call orthodox beliefs, who have done bad things. I think Christian nationalism is antichrist in nature, but does participate in a stream of Christianity that seeks power and control. But how about for you? Do you see it as just, it is not Christian at all? It's heretical in that sense? Or do you see it as, well, unfortunately, part of our tradition is reconciling and admitting that, yes, there have been some ugly things that have happened in the Christian name throughout history?
Well, I go through six iconic biblical texts here that are the ones that brought me back to Christ.
Yeah.
And the ones that I'm trying to reframe and refresh for right now. And take that history, the Galatians 3:28, in Christ. It's no longer male or female, Jew or Gentile, bond and free. We're all one in Christ. So right there, the early church, I discovered that was a baptism formula and rite in the early church. That text got read at every baptism. And they were saying, in effect, we are the ones who are followers of this itinerant Palestinian rabbi, Jesus. Mm. And he tells us to break down the barriers of race, class, and gender. Always the divisive, oppressive divisions in our societies, all connected. That text says we're overcoming. We're not perfect, but our vocation is to overcome these things. And so imagine that text being read at every Baptist in America today and saying, in effect, we try to break on these barriers. If you don't want to be a part of that, you better go somewhere else. Now, interestingly enough, to your historical question, Galatians 3:28 was removed from all the slaveholder Bibles. Gone. Disappeared. Just not there. And I believe that there are people out there, white Christians, some of whom are stuck, oblivious, trapped, and the only thing they'll be open to, finally, is Jesus. Every movement has to decide who we can persuade and who we have to defeat. I mean, nonviolently, at the ballot box, these militant, idolatrous Christian nationalists, they're political militants.
And 100%.
They have to be defeated. And we have to defeat them. And if we're able to finally beat back this threat, what they're trying to do is they want to prevent our changing demography from changing our democracy. That's, in a sense, voter suppression, gerrymandering, voter subversion, not counting all the votes. They just purged 6,000 black voters in Ohio. Purged them. And we're now in Ohio black churches, making everyone aware of who's registered and who's not, long before November. Are you on the rolls? You're not. Did you know that? So black churches, who are our leads in our Protect Democracy campaign, are challenging this directly. And so if we're able to defeat this bad religion, starting with the religious right in 1980, if we're able to defeat that, it opens up a whole possibility of what we can do going forward. So I'm very concerned when I hear people say, well, you know, just cycles, and 4 years from now we can do better, and let's blow the whole thing up. You know, let's just blow it up, because, you know, I don't like what Biden's doing in Gaza. I don't either, and I wrote against it yesterday again. Yeah. But we're talking about losing democracy here. So I'm doing everything I can to press this administration on lots of things. But we're not talking about in 4 years we can change our minds.
Yep.
We're talking about the loss of democracy and the loss of the authority of faith communities who stand with. This is, for me, a Bonhoeffer moment. This is the 1930s.
Wow.
This is what we're facing right now, to lose democracy in this country after all these years of barely holding on to it and never having it fulfilled. But now we're going to lose it altogether unless we all stand against what you say is Antichrist.
Friends, I am so excited to be partnering with Middle Church to promote their event, Freedom Rising, happening April 26th to the 28th, sponsored by the Candler Foundry and happening at Marble Collegiate Church in New York City. This is a three-day conference that you do not want to miss. Find rest, learn how to organize political power, and dream expansively about the world we deserve. And let me tell you, this is a monster speaker lineup with absolute legends, including Dr. Jackie Lewis, Reverend Dr. William Barbara, Reverend Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas, and Robert P. Jones, the founder of the PRRI Institute, which is the place I get all of my Christian nationalism data. This is going to be a three-day event full of learning about how to take care of you and your body, how to take action on crucial issues, and how to live into different ways of being in the world. I plan on being there, and I cannot wait to see you there as well. Get your tickets now at freedomrising.org and be part of this transformative experience. That's freedomrising.org, April 26th through the 28th in New York City. I'll see you there. You move the world. Unfortunately, doing this for a living, you end up learning too much, and you know, there's only so much you can cover in one day on the internet. For every one thing I share, there's 10 things behind the scenes that I'm like, oh my goodness. And there are things happening, whether it's Project 2025 or Project Blitz, some of the dark money that funds this, some of the big organizations like Turning Point USA that do a Turning Point last year did $80 million in funding. They have their own political arm now called Turning Point Action. They're starting their own Republican National Committee event that is in competition with the current RNC, because we all, I'm sure you know this as well, Jim, but for the audience out there, there's been a massive takeover of the RNC by these farther right, you know, people who are steeped in some ethic of white Christian nationalism. And I did go to America Fest in December. That's Turning Point's event. And to hear people from the stage, including Charlie, say, there is a great replacement. It's not a conspiracy. It's really happening. Immigrants are flooding our country to change the voting populace. When they're saying things that blatantly, and you can think about David Duke in the 80s and 90s saying the same exact thing, one of the grand wizards of the KKK, if that's not a five-alarm fire, if that is not, you know, a wake-up call, and of course, these folks are partnered deeply with many white evangelical churches, many of which are megachurches, I share your urgency of, yeah, we have a major problem. And I think the question then is, to your point, you mentioned that there are some people or some ideas that we have to defeat, and then there's the people that maybe we can persuade. For you, how do you draw those lines? Because I struggle with that, right? I want to have a posture of, hey, there's a better way forward in our faith than this, but also being strongly outspoken for the folks who are marginalized by these policies that, hey, this is not okay and we have to fight that. So how do you maybe talk about that in your book, et cetera?
I do. Do your listeners know who Charlie is?
Charlie Kirk? Oh, yeah, they know. They know.
Okay. Yeah. And Frank and Graham?
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay.
I'm saying these are false religious teachers.
Mm.
I'm saying they're preaching against the gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm saying let's have a debate anywhere, anytime with any of you about what Jesus said and what we mean by that. When Jesus says, you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free, he's not saying don't lie so much. He's saying the opposite of truth is captivity, is bondage. Truth and freedom are indivisible. I have a whole chapter on that. So how do we, John is full of talk about truth and talk about light. So how do we shine the light of truth into the darkness of lies? They are complicit in captivity. They are captive. Charlie is a religious fascist. He's mostly a political fascist. They're using religion for political power. Now, I'll debate him anytime, any place. He, Charlie Kirk, must be defeated. Defeated. And I'm happy to take him on anywhere. At 75, I'll also go anywhere to debate Charlie Kirk. Charlie, listen. Show up. He's a coward. They're cowards who won't talk about what Jesus said. And so we have to confront them with the words of Jesus. Not just MSNBC or Democratic Party or whatever. This is a test of faith. And so I think we have to take them on. And I think we have to win some people back.
Yeah.
And we have to let the scriptures do that. Like another chapter here is the Good Samaritan parable. The Good Samaritan can help lead us to multiracial democracy. Mm. I mean, the Judeans didn't think there were any Good Samaritans.
Right.
And what they said about Samaritans and what we hear Trump saying about people different than us. They're dangerous. They're drug dealers. They're killers. They're murderers. All that was said about the Samaritan. So here's Jesus. And a lawyer asked him the question. I know that lawyer's tone of voice. He was a Washington lawyer who asked Jesus the question, who is, he's not saying, who is my neighbor? How can I get out of obligation to this? Jesus chooses the other, the Samaritan, as his example of what it means to be a neighbor who helps an other than him, a Jewish man, lying by the side of the road, half dead. And so the Samaritan means, the chapter's titled, your neighbor likely doesn't live in your neighborhood.
Mm.
Your neighbor's not in your neighborhood. So how do we deal? And John Meacham, the great historian, says, it's all a matter of whether we're going to treat each other as neighbors or others, foreigners, and enemies. Their trajectory, Kirk's trajectory, is fear, hate, and violence. That is Antichrist. I'll just say it. Charlie, that's Antichrist. Read your Bible. Mm-hmm. Or let's read it together and debate it. But these texts, going back into these texts that brought me back to Christ, has been a powerful experience, because Jesus says, he doesn't say, blessed are the peace lovers, we all think we are, or the peacekeepers, often protecting the status quo. Peacemakers, which means the conflict resolvers. Christian nationalists are conflict makers.
Yeah.
They're trying to polarize. They're trying to divide. Jesus, no. I'm asking you to go into a polarized, divided, political violence rising society, and I want you to be peacemakers. And if you do, you're going to be the ones I call the children of God.
Hmm. I completely agree with you about your diagnosis of Charlie Kirk. As someone who has met the man, who has seen him speak many times, and who again hears a lot of his content, it's quite frustrating to watch someone speak so boldly and confidently about the Bible in ways that are just completely either untrue or just completely false, and convinces so many people. So, I mean, let me ask you this. Who is this book for? Are you trying to persuade some people with it, or is it more trying to give people like me further maybe ways of thinking about why this moment is so dire and so important?
Yeah, this book is a tool. It's a tool.
Yeah.
And I believe that the problem here is when white evangelicals or white Christians are more white than Christian, how do we bring the Christian back, or even the real meaning of evangelical back?
Right.
It's overwhelmingly white people, overwhelmingly, not just evangelicals, but white Catholics, white mainline Protestants, white people in general, are going to mostly vote for Donald Trump. Right? And so our black brothers and sisters, do we understand that black churches are having their members moved off the voting rolls? Do we understand that we're suppressing the votes? They're suppressing the votes of black brothers and sisters in Christ. That's what the Republicans are doing. That's a fact. So the book is also a tool to defeat them. Mm. Here's scripture. Here's language. Here's how we can fight this battle. It is a battle. Mm. I said soul of a nation before Joe Biden did, but it is for the soul of the nation. And so you know, I will do no harm to Charlie Kirk. I believe in nonviolence because of Jesus, but yeah. I wanted to defeat him politically.
Yeah.
And idolatrous religion, which is white Christian nationalism, must be defeated theologically.
Yeah.
So this isn't just politics. This isn't part of it. This is theology. So when, you know, imagine all the political noise around this right now. The first book of the Bible, first chapter, has a wonderful line. Imagine the noise. I have the noise all around me all the time. Then God said, like, shut up. Then God said, let us make humankind in our own image and after our own likeness. That's what God said. That's the foundation of human rights, voting rights, all that. So when people are trying to suppress the votes of people because of the color of their skin, or their age, or whatever, it is literally an assault on the image of God. Do we believe in the image of God or not? So I take those texts and I try to apply them to where we are now so we can come at these people. I don't think the answer to bad religion is no religion. Many of my friends on the left, that's what they think.
Yeah.
I don't agree. The answer to bad religion is better religion, is good faith. We got to defeat bad religion with good faith. So what's at stake here? And I'm just so encouraged by our conversations. A whole lot of people are hungry, and you're finding them, and they're listening, and they're paying, and they say, I'm not alone anymore. I have some other people whose story is like my story. The last chapter of the book is called The Remnant Church. Bonhoeffer began a confessing church in Germany. The German church supported Adolf Hitler. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he was here for a year at Union Seminary, and while he was here, went to Abyssinian Baptist Church. He's probably the only white guy in the crowd. And black preaching, black theology, black music shaped his confessing church. And he lost. He was hung in a concentration camp.
Yeah.
But right now, we need an American confessing church. I'm calling it a remnant church. And what I mean by that very simply is why you give me such hope is there will be a minority of white believers, a lot of younger, who are ready and willing to join black and brown church leaders in America and create literally a new American church. This book is for that, not just what's wrong. It's how do we create a new American church?
Well, I love to hear that because, frankly, speaking candidly in front of my audience, I think that a lot of folks get a little burnt out on me bringing always the bad news, right? Of just how dire things are. And it's not that they don't want to hear it. They do, but they also are like, okay, so what now then? Okay, I see, you're right, Tim, or, you know, Jim, I see the problem. I agree. I'm on board. What do we do? And, you know, actually, I'm recording this the day before. I'm actually flying out to meet with Reverend Otis Moss III. I'm flying out to him in Chicago. He's the main endorser on in the front of your book. So I'm looking forward to talking to him in Chicago for the weekend to see how, again, we can just keep building these networks. I tell you, and Jim, I told you this offline when we met a couple of weeks ago. I said, and I'm going to trigger half my audience using this language, but it is what it is. You know, I tell people all the time behind the scenes, I'm like, listen, in my opinion, to be evangelical for a second, the harvest is plenty and the workers are few. Meaning there are so many people out there who I talk to and meet who I know are hungry for a better way forward and who are looking for a way that is rooted in allegiance to Jesus, that wants to love all of their neighbors and wants to do better by all of their neighbors and sees the threat that, frankly, a lot of my faith tradition has birthed, right? I mean, we can think, this is just data, friends, and I've covered this many times. Some of the most recent polls show that, like in Virginia, for example, 76% of white evangelicals wanted Trump compared to about 35% of Republicans. And when it came to just Republicans, it was actually more for Haley than for Trump. So this is a very much a white evangelical problem. And so I'm encouraged, you know, to hear you say that. And it's encouraging for me to hear you say that, because I really do believe that if I've realized just enough that throughout this American history, there have been a remnant of white evangelicals who have always been pushing back on things, whether it's Theodore Weld and the anti-slavery movement, you know, whether it's Oberlin College, early Wesleyan tradition, Isaac Sharp's book, The Other Evangelicals, tells stories of the feminists and the black evangelicals and the gay evangelicals who have always been there pushing back. And I kind of see what we're doing in that tradition of, like, I know that in my circles or what birthed me, we're in a quote-unquote minority position. Yeah. But I don't care, and I like that. Like, I like being that hardcore fight the man kind of person, and I just think that this is one of those times where we have got to build those coalitions, and people like me need to learn quickly from other people who have been in this fight for a long time to do what we can to help, because I feel you. I feel like democracy is truly under threat. And I don't say that in the talk radio, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity way. We have real data that supports what we're saying, and that's the difference.
Well, our mutual friend, Diana Butler Bass, was the first podcast I did with this book. And I loved it when she said, Jim, this is a positive book. This is a positive book, not just a negative book. It's an Easter book. Easter book. And it's a book about resistance and hope at the same time. And I just can't tell you how hopeful what you just said makes me feel. When I talk to young white evangelicals like I do in this book, and I said, you know, you're only 20% of white evangelicals in that. And they say, I don't care. That's what the gospel says. I don't care. I got a whole lot of people that I'm working with. I don't care. So we've always been a minority. And these forces that would disturb, that would use, Gary Wills says here on the back, using religion to bless hate is the supreme blasphemy. Mm. If you don't believe that, read this book. If you do, urge others to read the book. We need it. Now, Gary Wills is one of the smartest people I've ever known in the world. And he's a scholar. He's a historian. He's saying, and he's a deeply committed Catholic. And so my work has been at evangelicals aimed at, but also Catholics. I'm a Jesuit now. So at Georgetown and mainline Protestants like Diana Butler Bass is now, and always black church. When I got kicked out of my white church, The Black Church took me in, and it's still my spiritual home. Otis Moss, Otis III is his nickname when you see him. He's that on the street. His father, Otis Jr., was in the inner circle of Dr. King. And I tell the story in the book how after Ferguson, I had our annual faith leaders retreat in Ferguson with the leaders of Black Lives Matter. And Otis was there. We gathered all the leaders from the streets, Black street leaders, Brittany Packnett, and he said, "You just changed me tonight. I speak prophetically. My tradition has taught me. My father, Dr. King, taught me. But I'm doing it too much from a place of comfort. I want to join you in the streets." And then when I preached in his church about a year later, always the Black Youth Project in Chicago is like Black Lives Matter other places. And these young kids, I'm an old guy, these young leaders showed up, and we talked about the sermon afterwards in Otis's office. So he's the right person to talk to. He's one of the greatest leaders, I think, in the church in America. He's bilingual in every way. He can do street, he can do academy, he can do arts, he can do movies, he can do it all. He can do jazz, he can do it all. And I trust in that kind of leader. Raphael Warnock spoke in my opening for this center in just Georgetown. I know Raphael from preaching in Ebenezer long before he was a senator. I preached in Ebenezer before he was even there. That's how old I am. But Raphael said, "Gee, I heard a rumor that you had retired. I see you just rewired." And this is what I'm doing in Georgetown. I'm rewiring. And to me, you all, what you're doing is a profound source of hope for me. And we got to understand that we don't, majorities never change anything. Minorities change things. And majorities say, "Okay, all right, let's go along with that." Dr. King was a minority of Black pastors who joined. The majority didn't want to go near it, right? Particularly when it came out against Vietnam and militarism, materialism, and racism. Yeah. So we're always going to be in the minority. That's our nature as the church.
Yes.
That's who we are. So the fact that you exist and your message and your growing, you know, community, I don't call it a constituency, it's a community. The growing community that you're forming is to me a great source of hope. So this book is written for them. It's a tool. It's not just to how to stop this stuff. It is that. But it's also how to build something new together.
Hi, friends. My name is Josh Scott. I'm the lead pastor of Grace Point Church in Nashville, Tennessee. Over the last several years, we've witnessed an alarming rise in hate, violence, bigotry, and nationalism here in the U.S. And it's all been fueled by and bound up with this distorted misunderstanding of the teachings of Jesus. These are critical days we're living in. This is literally an all hands on deck kind of moment. We must support the voices that are pushing back on these dehumanizing narratives and working instead for love, compassion, peace, and inclusion. That's why I'm so grateful for the work being done through Project Amplify, because they're doing just that. They are seeking to amplify voices and messages that resist these toxic and harmful narratives and offer a hopeful vision of our future in their place. If you think this work is important too, then we must join together and support it. Click the link below to contribute to this important cause now.
A lot of us found each other through the deconstruction explosion. That's a needed thing. I'm sure you went through your own, what you might call now deconstruction at some point in your life. And to be fair, some people after the explosion, they end up leaving the Christian tradition or they just move on to other things in life. And for me, that's not a moral judgment on them. I get it. I understand. People get really messed up by fundamentalism. Totally valid. There are people that are like, okay, great. I've deconstructed. But is the only goal just to stand on top of the rubble and say we did it? Like, what are we actually working towards? And that's why I think people like you and your book is so key. Can you share with the audience? I mean, you're probably, no lie, probably one of the most connected people I've ever met. You have connections everywhere. Can you give the audience, you don't have to name names, but just some hope that you see in some of the spaces with people that maybe see what you're seeing in our in positions of power, trying to, you know, find that better path forward and trying to save democracy. People always ask me for good news. So this would be a great time to share from your lips to our ears some good news that you see happening in all different areas of culture and politics and theology, of people really trying to be what you're talking about.
Well, the people who are listening to us right now are part of the good news for me. Yeah, when you're around a long time, as I've been around a long time, you have lots of relationships and lots of connections. So I do talk to a lot of people here and around the country who a lot of them are influencers, but they're feeling helpless. And they're feeling a lot of them feeling hopeless. So a lot of them come to me with, these are like very influential people, even Republican people and Democratic people, who feel scared and helpless and hopeless of what is taking over a whole political party. Yes. This isn't Republicanism. This is a march to authoritarianism that's taken over a whole party. So I did Steve Levitsky's new book, did a podcast with him called, you know, The Tyranny of the Minority, and that's what we're facing. So at that level, a lot of people are scared and feeling hopeless. So I'm going to come back to, I learned my theology of hope, really, a lot of it in South Africa, from Desmond Tutu, who's, my chair is delightfully named after my former mentor and friend. And here's what Desmond taught me: the difference between optimism and hope. Optimism is a feeling about how things look today. It's a mood. It's a personality. It's a cup half full, not cup half empty. Hope is deeper than all of that. Hope is a choice you make because of this thing that we call faith. Was Desmond Tutu optimistic most days under apartheid, when he, as a bishop, had to deal with the suffering of so many people? No, but he believed in hope because of his faith. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, says Hebrews, the evidence of things not seen, then watching the evidence change. Now, I've been doing that for a long time. Am I optimistic? I'm not sure how this is going to come out this year. I'm not sure. Because it's dealing with, you got a supreme marketer who's not just immoral, he's been immoral his whole life. He's amoral. There's no morality. And he's marketing racial grievance. Yeah. And he's marketing what I would say deeper theologically. He's marketing our worst demons in this country. And those demons run very deep. And our better angels are up against a lot right now. They're up against the faults in the Democratic candidate. They're up against this, the outcry we feel, all of us, in Gaza, which could impact the election. So I can't control. I said in my column, I do a column subset yesterday. I said, you can't control politics.
Yeah.
Only your own choices and your messenger. And so I can't control when people say you're influential and you feel all the influential people you know are feeling helpless and hopeless. It's a scary time. But finally, I'm going to go with my friend Desmond Tutu, who, when I arrived at the cathedral in St. George's on my first trip there during apartheid, I got snuck in the country to get past security. And I saw him surrounded by hundreds of military police outside his cathedral. And I'm just snuck in through all the soldiers to meet with him. And he's preaching, and they break down the door of his cathedral. And they're on the inside, on the walls, with tape recorders and pads saying, go ahead, be prophetic. You just got out of prison, we'll put you back. Go ahead, you be prophetic. Ha ha. And he starts preaching. He just stops and hangs his head in prayer. And then he looks up and says, and they're right there, inside and outside his cathedral. South African security police are thugs. I've been interrogated by them. They're thugs. And he said, you are powerful. You are very powerful, but I serve a God who will not be mocked. So, since you have already lost, we invite you today, and it begins bouncing like a good Black Baptist preacher, we invite you today to come and join the winning side. And we leapt up, and young people danced us out of the church, and the soldiers didn't know what to do. Here's these dancing worshipers who aren't afraid of them. 10 years later, I'm at the inauguration of Nelson Mandela, and Desmond Tutu is the master of ceremony. I said, Bishop, do you remember that day in St. George's? He smiled. I said, today they've all joined the winning side, because everybody that day was always against apartheid, right? So what he taught me was this trajectory. Faith sparks hope, which causes action, which makes change. Faith, hope, action, and change. That's my trajectory of how things change. And so I just have to have the faith creates the hope that really causes us to take action, even sacrificial action. If this election goes the way I'm afraid it might, I don't know what's going to happen to a lot of us. We're going to be targeted. But it makes change. And I've seen that in South Africa. I've seen that all over the world. I've seen it here. So I'm not optimistic every day, I'll admit, but I am hopeful. And the people listening to you today, to us, are some of the reasons that I feel hopeful.
That is a beautiful note to end this conversation on. I love that. I think that gives the audience some steps for actionables. I get that often too. What can I do? Well, here you go. You know, and obviously I can't give people step-by-step ingredient advice because they live in different contexts in different parts of the country and have different access to different things. But I love that. Friends, the book is The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy. It's out April 2nd. I know that pre-orders are a big deal in the book world. So if this podcast, which will be out before then, hits your ears before then, please go and pre-order the book. I'll make sure I put a link in the show notes. Jim, where can folks find your other work? I mean, you obviously are an author. You said you have a Substack. Do you have a different social media presence? Where can folks listen to you?
Well, the Substack is called God's Politics. It's my name, Substack. It's free. I don't charge anything for it. It's all free. And the podcast I do, you can look on YouTube. It's called or Apple, The Soul of a Nation. That's what my podcast was called before Joe echoed that. So Soul of a Nation and Substack and just the Center on Faith and Justice at Georgetown, we have a project called The Theology of Democracy. For us, this is not just political or partisan. It's deeply theological. So we're having events all the time. You can get on our website or our list. So the Center for me is critical. I'll say one more group, Faith United to Save Democracy. We've been three elections now. We've trained 1,000 poll chaplains, clergy, and bishops who go to imperiled polling places. And I said to the lawyers, how about some collars? Lawyers and collars. So that's what we do. We provide collars, clergy and other Christian leaders, to be in polling places where you got white guys carrying guns while Black people are lined up to vote. We surround them and move them out, or pickup trucks outside Black elementary schools. It's not just activists and lawyers, it's clergy saying we need to resolve this. So Faith United to Save Democracy, we're training poll chaplains in critical states around the country. And so I'm in the middle of all of that. And it's multiracial. It's multi-faith. We got rabbis and imams joining us too. And it's multi-generational. And I was able to get Steph Curry to do a great video for us on why vote. And Steph's a Christian. And he doesn't just pray for three-point shots. He cares about social justice. And I got Steph to do that for us. So,
well, God must be listening to Steph if that guy's praying for three-point shots and other things, because he obviously drains them from wherever he wants to. So that is wonderful. Jim, it is, like I said earlier, really an honor to have you on. Whatever this new thing that people like me and others are trying to do certainly stands on the shoulders of folks like yourself who have paved the way and who have given us foundations to think about theology different. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for that. And I'm looking forward to working more together this election cycle and, you know, seeing what the future
holds.
And beyond. I'm all about it. We'll talk again soon.
Bless you. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.